Ken Nash, and with Mimi Rosenberg, we are Building Bridges. We're joined now by Nelson Lichtenstein, labor historian, activist, formerly director of the Department of History of the University of Santa Barbara, where he directed the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Nelson is the author or editor of 18 books, and his latest book is Why Unions Matter, a study of how and why the labor question has become such a pressing issue.
Nelson is with us to take account of the good, the bad, and the ugly of the organized and organizing workers' movement of 2024, and then assess what the MAGA juggernaut means for labor in 2025 as we get ready to don our armor in preparation for Project 2025. Well, Professor Nelson Lichtenstein, your response to the workers' organizing efforts, to begin with, at Amazon and the recalcitrance of that behemoth company to thwart the workers' just demands. How does this typify and explain the era or the year that we are exiting?
We have two things that are going on at the same time, which are almost canceling each other out. On the one hand, there's no doubt in the last year and the year before and before that, we have a heightened level of interest in unions by workers, activism, self-activism. Unions like the Teamsters have, you know, they understand we must organize Amazon. And they had a bit of a strike of several of the distribution centers just recently. But at the same time, despite this new activism and public support of unions, which has never been higher in many decades, companies remain absolutely intransigent for the most part. And Amazon, which employs upwards of a million workers in its distribution centers, is absolutely typical of that. And those two things are at the same time. It's not exactly, I don't think an explosion is coming precisely, but those two things are there. And you can find this in other places as well, at Starbucks and Auto and lots of other places. It has been a period in the last year and the year before of considerable working class and union activity, which gives heart to many of us, and no doubt about that. But the remarkable thing is, or not the remarkable thing, but the predictable thing, and it will only get worse under Trump, is that the companies have remained intransigent. I can say this is not always normal. That is, in other periods of working class advance, whether it was the 30s or the 60s, or today in academia would be another example. Managers, executives, owners say, well, I guess we better accommodate something. Otherwise, it'll be continual strife. So that happened in the 30s. It happened in public employment in the 60s. It happened in some places with African American workers in the 60s and 70s. And it's happening in academia today. That's just a small slice. But places like Stanford or NYU, or they say, well, I guess we better agree to recognition and higher wages, because otherwise we'll get chaos. But that's not happening in most of American industry.
Professor Lichtenstein, it's a big country. The growth of unions and the response by the employers, is that differs state by state?
Well, to a degree, although I would no longer say that, well, the South is reactionary, and yes, of course, it's difficult there. But, in Michigan or New York State, things are all different. But I don't think that the difference is that great. I think whether we're talking about, say, hospitals or banks or Amazon, of course, or Walmart, these are national companies. There are some states have higher levels of union density, California, New York, Hawaii, et cetera. But it's overwhelmingly the case that companies are resist unionism, for the most part. That's the standard operating procedure. Yes.
Let's just take a look for a moment at what you think has happened in the last 10 years with labor law. That has been a significant inhibitor not an inhibitor, but a prohibition, really, on the facilitation of workers, or would you disagree, organizing?
No, I agree. I mean, for the most part, the trajectory of labor law in the United States over the last, decades has been increasingly to make it more difficult to organize, to make things that used to be legal, illegal. and that's been true. The courts, it's not just the NLRB, but then the courts get a hold of it. And in general, that has been the case, whether it's, making it more difficult to boycott companies, to a concerted activity, free speech on the job, captive audience meetings, etc. And so it's been made increasingly difficult. Is a shopping center open to people to hand out leaflets, or can you do that in the break room? So many small things adding up to make it very difficult to organize. Certainly not the vision of the framers of the Wagner Act in 1935, who said, we want workers should have unions of their own choosing. Employers, stay out. Just stay out. Not you. Later on, you can have your say later on when the bargaining begins. But when it comes to unionism, get lost. Now, what we have had under Biden was in fact remarkably liberal NLRB and with Ambrosio, with
Nelson, let me just stop you long enough to say,
yeah, sure.
Not everybody knows what the NLRB is, National Labor Relations Act, and the function it provides. So just interject that as you continue on that course.
Yes. When it comes to private sector employment, that would include Amazon and Walmart and Starbucks, the government agency that has a lot to say about how the rights of unions and of workers and which facilitates elections, which is the normal way, not always, but the normal way in which workers express their interest in a union, is the National Labor Relations Board, which was created in 1935 under the Wagner Act. It's been around for a long time. And it has, unfortunately, even when you have liberals on the NLRB running it, the courts can sort of trumpet, can sort of, they can declare things that the NLRB does illegal or not, unconstitutional or not. So that's another story, and they intervene a lot. However, under Biden, and this was really, I think, partly the influence of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others and the labor movement, the NLRB has been quite liberal and has sought to make many more mechanisms for workers to form unions, and has tried to stop some of the anti-union activities. One of the most important, for example, is the so-called captive audience meetings, where an employer insists that all the workers attend a meeting, they must, mandatory, and then they are propagandized, with anti-union messages, often by very expensive and sophisticated anti-union law firms. So the NLRB has been quite liberal under Biden, and that's been a great thing and a good thing. And unfortunately, that will be reversed under Trump.
But let me ask you this, since there's that notion of the labor president, if you will, Joseph Biden. But here we have the Richard Trumka Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which became known as the PRO Act, right?
Yeah.
It was a proposed law that would amend previous labor laws, such as the National Labor Relations Act, for the purpose of expanding various labor protections related to employees' rights to organize and collectively bargain. And yet, nothing really has been done. I don't remember any forceful statement or promotion of the PRO Act by the Biden administration. Clearly, one of the most important things that could happen, which is attack tackling these laws to prohibit or inhibit in every way workers being able to unionize.
Yeah, let me put it this way. You're right. The PRO Act was failed in Congress. The Democrats had a very slim majority, and that wasn't enough because several of the Democrats defected on that question. So it failed. And did Biden put the entire weight of the administration behind trying to pass the PRO Act? No, he did not. However, I would say this. Then the NLRB said, well, we're going to try to, in effect, enact the PRO Act in a piecemeal fashion. I'll make this point. When employers are intransigent and are willing to take the bad public relations and the money it costs to resist a union, they can do that, PRO Act or no PRO Act. And that is essentially what has been happening. They have decided to stonewall. And even beyond that, now, as you know, the Amazon and Starbucks Tesla, all of which have been, you know, had some union activity at their companies, have entered the courts to declare the entire many parts of the National Labor Relations Act enacted again in 1935 unconstitutional, and that is in the courts right now. And who knows what's going to happen, because the there are these very conservative judges that, you know, in Texas and other places. So in that respect, while I'm frankly, I do applaud the Biden administration for appointing liberals in many places. When capital is intransigent, it really does require something more than politics as usual to advance unionism. And I have to just say the statistics are that despite the activity. And that's the most important thing, the self-activity of many, many workers. Despite all of that, the proportion of American working class represented by unions has not increased in the last 4 years.
Nelson, in addition to that, many, many, many workers work not for a private employer, but by a state, local, or national government. Yeah. How are these workers making out in this context?
Yes, thank you for raising that, because the other kind of part of labor law is that covered by, it covers public employees. And that is not covered by the National Labor Relations Board. It's covered by various state laws, which now here they Northern, Northeastern, West Coast, not in the South, not the Mountain West, and they're you know, so there, if it's public employees, including university people, including various kinds of just, you know, sometimes hostates, you know, whether it's, and then of course all sorts of the functions of the state government, there, you have a much more robust union sector. That's been about 30-35% of public employees are in unions, much, much higher than in the private sector, where it's about 6%. And there in that, and here where public universities are covered by these state laws, there you've had a tremendous activity and successful activity, both in California and in places in Massachusetts, New England, and places like that. You have in fact had a union advance in that sector. Now, whether you think it's important that graduate students and postdocs are in unions, you know, that is an exact working class we've traditionally thought about, but nevertheless, they have been joining. And that's the one place where many university executives, whether they're private or public, whether it's Stanford, USC, or NYU, or the University of Michigan, or Cornell, they have said, okay, I guess this is the coming thing, and we will agree to recognize unions and raise wages. And that is one thing that has happened. Now, it's not It's not that big a sector of the working class, and it is a kind of very narrow strata, but that has been happening.
I also want to ask you about my union, the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys, which is a local that is in local, that is local 2325. We're part of the UAW. So a lot's been said about the United Auto Workers Southern Offensive and their stand-up strike. What do you think these efforts have meant for propelling the labor movement forward? I mean, how do you look at that Organizing the South campaign, and how do you look at the stand-up strike? Was that a shot in the arm, a kick in the ass to the Volkswagen and the Mercedes-Benz, and to some degree his response, that is Sean Fain, the president, to non-communication, if you will, with the Trumpian monster, the Agent Orange, Donald Trump?
Well, let me say two things about that. I had the pleasure to be in the audience when I think it was the president of your local of legal aid attorneys from New York was speaking at a UAW kind of meeting, and I was there. And she and they were and the panel was about, you know, international affairs and Gaza. And she made this point, which I thought was really interesting and good. That while and then your local had as I understand it has endorsed a resolution which is critical of the Israeli assault on Gaza and has called for a ceasefire, and she made the point that far from this being controversial or divisive within this group of defense attorneys, it was a unifying factor. It helped strengthen the union, and that the union should not can are they are for bread and butter things, but when the membership is an international issue, a humanitarian issue, then it's right and proper for the union to endorse that, and that had a unifying effect. I thought that was extremely interesting, given the critique of that, which was found in the newspapers, and the unions divided over Gaza. I thought that was very interesting. Now, and you undoubtedly know a lot more about that than I. Now, when it comes to the UAW as a whole, of course, one of the great victories of 2024, undoubtedly one of the great victories, was the overwhelming victory of the UAW at Volkswagen in Chattanooga. And I later went to Chattanooga and talked to some people there. And, you know, it was it reflects, you know, the larger pro-union impulse, which is not just among grad students or defense attorneys, but is within the blue-collar working class, undoubtedly, and including in the South. And this was an overwhelming victory. And they are now having a very democratic fashion are negotiating a first contract, which I think will in fact be agreed to, and I think then it will pass. I think that is a very hopeful thing. And of course, as I've written, when in 1863, when the Union Army defeated the Confederates at Chattanooga, President Abraham Lincoln declared Chattanooga the gateway to the South, to the Confederacy. And I think it is. I think it still is when it comes to the unionism, because there are many German-owned factories in South Carolina and in Georgia, and that is the next target of the UAW. Now, at Mercedes, again another German company in Alabama, they failed to win a NLRB election about a month later. That would be in May of 2024, but they're going to come back, and I think this is undoubtedly a very hopeful thing for the union movement. And I think Sean Fain and the UAW has put good resources. And I make one more point about this. Very interesting. Union organizers. Well, yes, you want Southern, you know, born and bred, you know, union organizers, you know, with Southern accents and, you know, from the local, you know, you want. But you also want, and the UAW has put in place in the South, you know, red hot, politically adept, grad students and people who led difficult big strikes at the University of California and other places, and they've gone to Chattanooga and to Spring Hill, Tennessee, and Nashville. And, you know, they're doing a good job. They're not like the locals are not saying, get out of here, Yankees. We don't want you. No, they're doing a good job. So I think we are in a better place in some respects there.
One of the things that a number of people have written to me lately is, look, the reason the labor movement has a roughly 11%, despite the fact that there's more interest now than there's been in the last 10 years, there is no longer a working class, if you will. Marx's conceptualization is obsolete. There is just a huge precariat, and more and more and more, we're going to be in precariat situations. And so there really isn't a working class as we knew it. So the issue of organizing unions in industry lines just doesn't work. So forget it. Think of other ways of organizing and relating to people. A lot of reactionary components to that line of thought, but indeed your thought about the fact that there is a large precariat workforce and where that takes us or should take us. I don't know. You can look at it from the Uber drivers and so on in terms of organization of the working class to really bargain for, of course, their wages and benefits, but certainly for workers' empowerment.
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that capitalists and managers in the last few decades have tried to construct a working class or their employees, which is precarious, and that's one of the great grievances of people who work in the whole retail, you know, sector from Walmart to Starbucks, etc. Is, hey, I'd like to have a regular work week here, you know, I'd like to have a predictable work week. And one of the first demands of any union impulse, and you know, at places like the fast food places or Whole Foods or Starbucks or wherever is, hey, we'd like to have a regular work week with predictable work week. That's what we want. And the business model of these corporations has been, no, they want something quite, more precarious and flexible from the point of view of management, not the workers. And then, of course, with Uber and Lyft and the app-based platforms, they are trying to make this a kind of a legal organizational. That is, well, we don't even employ people. They're all independent contractors. And I mean, they've taken that one step farther, and that's a big issue. But look, all these people are workers, and we have a working class. It varies over time, and of course today it's not just blue collar workers. There's tremendous numbers of people who are pink, you know, white, gray collars, and you know, all over. And in fact, the odd thing is that in New York and Boston, you know, great strides are being made in the world of what C. Wright Mills called the cultural apparatus. That is, you know, museum workers and hospitals and postdocs and people of that. They get paid as on a salary, and it's inadequate, and they have a precarious life because after a year or two they're tossed out, you know. And so a unionization is taking place there with some success. But of course we have a working class. I mean for 250 years corporations, managers, capitalists have tried to manipulate the working class and structure it in such a way to their benefit, but people, you know, have to go to work and they have to get an income. We aren't beyond that. Wages for work, that's for sure. Work for wages. I mean, I do think it makes it more difficult, and I think the law, in other words, the law does not fit the reality of the work. That's the problem, and so we have to either change the law or ignore the law. I think in moments of great social upheaval, you ignore the law, whether it's the civil rights movement or the sit down strikes of the 30s or things that have been happening, in some places recently. And I think that's what we're going to. Let me say one more thing. I'll just inject this. I know it's on your mind. Of Trump's victory was a disaster and a downer, but of among the within the union movement. not that there are unionists who are pro-Trump. There are unionists who are pro-Trump, or even union leaders who are pro-Trump. But thinking about people who are not, who are more, you know, more militant, more democratic, more liberal, I think the Trump victory will have less impact on the possibility of the labor movement doing things than perhaps on other sectors of the progressive side of American politics. I think I think many in the union say, yeah, Trump won, but it wasn't our fault he won. It was the fault of the Democrats. So I'm not disheartened at this moment particularly.
I must say, since you mentioned Trump, 2025, a thought. And that is, or concern, to what extent do you think that we can mobilize, we must, but that we can mobilize and politicize the unions to support the undocumented workers who are scheduled for a slaughter, for a deportation at this juncture? How much is that significant as an issue and agenda that the working class as a whole must pursue?
Well, you know, one of the things that is actually in a very progressive thing about the labor law as it exists in America today, despite problems, is that you can be an undocumented worker and be a bona fide member of a trade union, and you can vote in an election. And in fact, one of the progressive things that did happen with the NLRB and the Biden administration is they passed a regulation which said when there's a union campaign, all deportation procedures will be held in abeyance for up to 4 years. You know, while the union, while the issue of who gets to be in the election and the outcome of the election, the NLRB election takes place, this and so in effect it's saying, you know, it's irrelevant if you're undocumented when it comes to the, you know, your right and capacity to participate in a NLRB election. Now, whether it's you're talking about the Teamsters, who were the leadership at least, or the O'Briens trying to play footsie with Trump, or a couple other unions, you know, of that sort, I think that, you know, if you come to the point where the ICE is rounding up undocumented immigrants who are a potential part of a union campaign to, you know, get representation in a factory or some other place, the unions are going to be are regardless of the political coloration of their leadership are going to be really pissed about that and are going to respond, because that is a huge negative for union organizing, and that's true even of this guy O'Brien, who I think is making a giant mistake, and he's going to be he's been going down to Mar-a-Lago. He's the Teamster. He's still trying to organize Amazon, and there are thousands and thousands of undocumented workers who are working at Amazon. You're going to start rounding them up. That's going to put a stake through the organizing campaign of the Teamsters at Amazon. So I think the union movement will resist that very strongly.
Well, Professor Lichtenstein, we do thank you for this beginning insights into the world of working people. And for more by you, people should go to one of your new books, which is Why Unions Matter. Thank you very much for being here.
Professor Nelson Lichtenstein, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash for Building Bridges, your community and labor report.